Are you ready?
Yeah, we're ready.
Laura, now we're ready. Okay, good afternoon, everybody, and I'll call the Wednesday, February 3rd meeting of the Senate Commerce and Workforce Development Committee to order. We have a very full and very exciting agenda of three bills to take up today. So without further ado, we're going to just jump right in and get started, and I will start by opening a public hearing and work session on Senate Bill 990. Members, we did have informational testimony on the concepts that are presented in this bill, which I believe everybody who's sitting here right now was here to hear. We're going to have a brief reprise of that testimony. This is an extremely important bill. And Jim, now that it's in its official form, would you like to tell us what Senate Bill 990 is?
Yes, Madam Chair, members, this is Senate Bill 990. It authorizes emergency extension of unemployment insurance benefits beginning the week that is at least 14 days after the measure's effective date and ending when the total emergency benefits paid reaches $19 million.
Thank you, Jim. And I see that the Employment Department is in the room, so I'll ask Tom Byerly to come forward and explain this probably for about the 10th time in the last 48 hours. We were just trying to see if you keep your story straight. So, and it looks like we will not have any audio problems. So this morning I was listening to you and your mouth was moving but no sound was coming out, so I don't think we'll have that problem now.
A little bit of an echo with your...
Thank you, Chair Rosenbaum, member of the committee. My name is Tom Byerly. I'm the administrator of the Unemployment Insurance Division of the Employment Department, as I said, in House Labor this morning. Stop me if you heard this story before. Should have some testimony there in front of you, just a brief overview. We did talk about this concept and where the Unemployment Insurance Trust Fund is, the level of claims when the committee met on Monday. Now directly to Senate Bill 990. It has two parts. First, it reauthorizes Oregon Emergency Benefits, which was an extension of unemployment insurance benefits paid out of the state trust fund. This part would pay up to 6 weeks of benefits to those that are eligible on their, or is 23% of their most recent regular claim, whichever is less. Their weekly benefit amount doesn't change, it stays the same, so they would get 1 to 6 weeks of benefits. Secondly, Senate Bill 990 authorizes the Employment Department to continue paying extended benefits that actually reach back during an emergency unemployment compensation period to expend additional federal dollars. No state trust fund money would be used, and it would allow the Employment Department at any time the feds offered payment of an extension of more than 50% of the bill that we could use that to pay benefits. As we have spoken, Oregon Emergency Benefits comes from, actually was originally developed in House Bill 3483 in 2009. It had a cap of $30 million at that point. It was also for a set period of time from October 4th, 2009 to January 2nd, 2010. Because the feds extended the emergency unemployment compensation extension in November, the need for those dollars was reduced significantly, and we spent $11 million of that $30 million, leaving $19 million that was actually accounted for from the trust fund in 3483 but was not expended and could be used for this extension in Senate Bill 990. Should the second part of the bill be passed, we think about 1,000 people would come in on the extended benefits portion from the federal government. It would mean several million dollars could come to the Oregon's economy through federal coffers. Be happy to answer any questions if you have any.
Great. Well, thank you for such a clear and succinct explanation. Members, did you have any additional questions to the ones we asked the other day? I don't see any, so thank you very much, Tom.
Thanks for having me again.
We have two more people signed up to testify on this bill, and am I getting an echo off the sound system, or are we okay? Laura?
Sounds a little like echoey up here, but I think
there's a little bit here, but I don't think it's up here.
I think it's better than this morning.
Yeah, definitely we're being heard out in the larger...
Hello? Can you hear us now?
Great. Okay, so I'm going to call together Arthur Towers and J.L. Wilson, if you could both come forward. Good afternoon, and welcome to the Senate Commerce and Workforce Development Committee. And J.L., welcome back. You're getting to be a regular user of that chair.
Thank you. Senator Rosenbaum and members for the record, J.L. Wilson with Associated Oregon Industries, just reiterating formally our support for Senate Bill 990 for the record. We supported House Bill 3483 last session. To the extent that this is unallocated funds from that allocation, we support it to get it out in the economy and help the unemployed workers. And the second part of the proposal, which extends the time frame for the reach back, we also support. So the bill in its whole, we support.
Thank you for those comments. Please go ahead.
Thank you. For the record, my name is Arthur Towers, Political Director for Service Employees Union Local 503. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today. Excuse me. This bill is something that we support strongly. It's another in a series of good steps to help with the social safety net and help Oregonians who have been victimized by the downturn in the economy. 3483, as was mentioned, was a good step. The passage of Measure 66, which lowered taxes on the unemployed, was a good step. This bill is a good step. I also want to flag for you a next step that I think is going to be important here later on in the session, and that is the extension of employment-related daycare. This is a program for working families that is set to be curtailed June 30th. At that time, 5,500 children of working parents will lose their subsidized daycare. That affects 2,900 working families and probably will cost the jobs of about 1,800 care providers, many of whom do not even qualify for unemployment insurance. Again, the idea behind this program is that working families who aren't making very much money would be able to afford daycare with employment-related daycare, but they wouldn't be able to really afford to go to work because they couldn't afford daycare without the subsidy. So, again, we just wanted to give the heads up to this committee that that's another project along these same lines that we should be aware of going forward. It's a cost of about $15.9 million to preserve funding for these 5,500 kids for another 12 months. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for your comments. And seeing no questions, thank you very much for the nice moment of kumbaya. So I think I opened both the public hearing and a work session on this bill at the same time, and it looks like the administrator's letting me get away with doing that. So we are in a work session. Vice Chair Telfer, did you have a motion?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I move Senate Bill 990 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Telfer has moved Senate Bill 990 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Senator Monroe.
Yeah, it gives me a great deal of pleasure to support this measure, as I have others that extended unemployment benefits during this very tough economic time. Not only is it good for those people who are recipients, but this is good for the business community as well, because people have money that they can spend on groceries. People can pay their rent, so landlords like me don't have to go through FEDs and evict poor folks because they're unemployed and can't afford to pay their rent. It's just overall, it's probably the most important thing we could do in this kind of an economic climate to provide safety net for the folks out there who are victims of this high unemployment rate.
Good comments, and I would certainly second those comments and just add that I think the money that's represented here not only will go to supporting people while they're working and looking for work, but also money that's going to get spent, as we know, around the state, in our local communities, in our local businesses, and that should give us a little help in that way, too. So seeing no further comments, Laura, would you please call the roll for the first time this session?
Senator George.
Aye.
Other list.
Yeah.
Different committee.
Okay. Senator Moreau.
Aye.
Senator Polanski.
Aye.
Senator Telfer.
Aye.
Rosenbaum.
Aye. Motion carries, and the chair will carry the bill. And I will close the public hearing and work session on Senate Bill 990. And give us a moment to switch gears here. Okay. And I'll open a public hearing on Senate Bill 1017. And members, this is a bill that we have not looked at before, so we will ask the administrator to explain it. And Jim, do we have the sign-up sheet on this one?
It's coming.
It's coming.
It's right on its way.
Great. Okay, so please go ahead.
Madam Chair, members, Senate Bill 1017 increases the maximum amount of Oregon Business Development Fund loans to more than 50% of project costs if the applicant has been denied by two or more lenders and has no other available financing. It increases the maximum business development loan authority of the director of the Business Development Department from $100,000 to $250,000. It expands eligibility for entrepreneurial development loans to include all existing businesses that grossed less than $500,000 the previous year. Members, this bill has a subsequent referral to Ways and Means, and it has a blank in it. It appropriates a blank amount of money from the Tax Amnesty Fund for business development projects. That blank would be filled in at Ways and Means.
Thank you, Jim. And I see that Senator Bonamici, one of the chief sponsors of the bill, is here. So if you'd like to come forward, did you have any friends that you wanted to bring
thank
with you. Or we'll just call them in
if
due
you
order?
To call them. I'm just, thank you, Senator, Chair Rosenbaum, committee. I'm just going to do a brief overview, and then if you want to call them, I may need to go back to the committee next door.
Great. So, thank you.
Thank you, Senator Rosenbaum and committee members. I'm Suzanne Bonamici, State Senator for Senate District 17. Thank you so much for hearing this bill today, and thank you to the co-sponsors who offered their support. Some of you are on the committee. Senate Bill 1017, as your committee administrator explains, makes some temporary changes to the law to make it easier for small businesses in Oregon to obtain loans from the state's Business Development Fund and Entrepreneurial Development Loan Fund. The Oregon Business Development Fund is a revolving fund that provides long-term fixed-rate financing for small businesses, especially in rural or distressed areas. And the Entrepreneurial Development Loan Fund provides initial direct loans to help small business companies get started or continue here in Oregon, again, many of them in rural areas. The changes in Senate Bill 1017 are designed to help keep Oregon small businesses and job creators going and to withstand the current economic crisis and credit crunch. Now, representatives from Business Oregon are here today to provide you with details of the changes, and your committee administrator told you about some of those. But in general, the Business Development Loan Fund changes, there are some changes to the financial partner requirement, and in some circumstances, the loan can now exceed 50% of the cost of the project. And also, it changes the amount of a loan that the director has discretion to make an opinion about. From $100,000 to $250,000. In the Entrepreneurial Development Loan Fund, currently participants must meet two of three criteria, be in operation for 36 months or less, have revenues of less than $175,000 in the previous 12 months, or be a business owned by a severely disabled person. So it's two out of the three currently. And some of those restrictions have shown to be somewhat artificial. And under Senate Bill 1017, the 36-month requirement is removed, and the $175,000 revenue ceiling is raised to $500,000. The bill also changes the collateral requirement from fully secured to secured by good and sufficient collateral. Now, I want to emphasize that these funds and the Business Oregon people can confirm this have had an excellent record and have been very successful to date in helping small businesses in our state. These are modest changes, but important, especially in these difficult economic times. But nonetheless, these provisions sunset in June of 2011, which will give us an opportunity to assess how the changes are working and revisit them in the next session if changes are needed to be made or if we desire to make these changes permanent. Finally, as your committee administrator noted, this bill has a subsequent referral to Ways and Means. It is my understanding that the Tax Amnesty Fund is collecting funds that perhaps are more than anticipated. We will be asking Ways and Means to provide additional funds to these loan programs. This is an excellent way to stimulate the economy, and as we know, as I heard Senator Rosen Rosenbaum say today, one of the most important things that we're doing here in February, getting Oregonians back to work. So I thank you so much for hearing this bill today. I respectfully ask that you send Senate Bill 1017 to the floor via Ways and Means with a do-pass recommendation. And thank you for your time. And I'm happy to answer any questions, although I may defer to the experts in the room as well.
Well, thank you, Senator Bonamici, for the work that you've put into this thus far and also for sparing a little time from your committee work next door. Yes, Senator Telfer.
Madam Chair, thank you. And Senator Bonamici, you may not have the information because we sit on revenue, and the amnesty program was expected to raise about $16 million, and my understanding is right. It's in excess of $20 million. Do we have a final number on...
I did actually speak to legislative revenue today, and I believe...
Do you have a more current number?
Let me find my notes. I believe that it is more than was anticipated. At present, I was told today that there has been about $32 million deposited from that program.
So twice what it was anticipated. Okay. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Great.
Thank you very much.
I don't see any other questions, so it looks like
you
are free to go. Thank you very much for joining us. Looks like we have four people signed up, but we also have the director of the Business Development Department. So, Director McCabe, if you wanted to come forward, I don't know if you had anybody you were bringing with you, but please feel free. And while you're getting settled, I notice that quite a few members of this committee are also co-sponsors of this bill, so it looks like there's a lot of interest in it.
Chair Rosenbaum, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Tim McCabe, Director of Oregon Business Development Department, known as Business Oregon. I'm here in support of Bill 1017. My department, for the past 2 years, we engaged with a lot of businesses in Oregon. This fund, the Oregon Business Development Fund, and our Credit Enhancement Fund have been instrumental in helping Oregon businesses not only maintain business during this period, this very difficult period, but actually grow. We've brought with us today a couple of business examples so you can learn firsthand how these programs have benefited them. But this access to capital is probably the most important thing we're doing today. These funds are stretched as thin as they can be stretched right now. Our Credit Enhancement Fund is right now at $8 million. We've used it to leverage $14 million in loans from banks. We could do a lot more if we had more money. Not that I'm asking for more money, but it's these funds that enable Oregon businesses to succeed. I have with me John Saris, our finance manager in the department. So if you have any specific questions around how we will administer these funds or the need for them, we'll be happy to answer those.
Great. Well, thank you for those comments. I know that when we had an informational hearing and we had a lot of small business people, particularly from Deschutes County, thanks to Vice Chair Telfer, we heard a lot about just the difficulty of obtaining financing in this rough economy and with tight credit markets. And so clearly there's a lot of interest already in what good can be done by this fund. So are there questions for these witnesses? Yes, Senator Monroe.
There's a blank in the bill that will be filled in Ways and Means. Do you have a number that you're going to be asking Ways and Means to fill in that little blank?
Chair Rosenbaum, Senator Monroe, Rosenbaum, excuse me. We haven't asked for a specific amount. You're going to be faced with some tough decisions, and we're going to leave that to your discretion. I mean, any amount. Obviously, we'd like as much as we can get, but we'd be very appreciative of any of
that. We just heard that the tax amnesty is bringing in a considerably more money than we had anticipated, and that's a very good thing. So
right.
I wondered if you had a number in mind. You'd have to ask, you know. And that doesn't mean Ways and Means and Legislative Fiscal will wholeheartedly agree with you, but you might be, you know, thinking on that. And I would certainly, I'm on Ways and Means, I would certainly suggest that you have a number in mind and that you let them know what you think would be appropriate.
Senator Monroe, Chair Rosenbaum, members of the committee, we'll be happy to do that. We know what kind of activity is going on and how many loan applications we've got out there. So we can look two different ways, one to meet the immediate needs and maybe a little bit longer term into 2011 as this sunsets, so it's not cut off completely. But, yeah, we'll be happy to do that.
Thank you.
Madam Chair.
Great. Yes, Senator George, one of the co-sponsors.
Well, since we have a majority of the committee is actually co-sponsors, maybe we ought to just fill in our own number right now and then send them and then let them try to cut back.
Sounds like
small business.
A number somewhere between.
We just put ways and means in a little box that we want them to be put in. So.
But Chair Rosenbaum and members of the committee, I think an interesting thing is we just approved two loans today totaling $150,000. These are going to create 14 new jobs and maintain 20 jobs within the state. One's in Grants Pass and the other is in
Baker City.
So these are, you know, these are small companies in rural communities that are distressed communities. So these funds are extremely important.
Yes, Senator Pruszynski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The director left me a business card today because I unfortunately wasn't there. And on the back, he was talking about the pendants I have for the different universities. And he had trouble with one of the color coordinations. I wasn't sure if it was the yellow and green or if it was the orange and black.
The sequence was right. The yellow and green was in the front. The orange and black was in second place, as is.
There was a community college before that, so that's why I wasn't sure which one you were talking about. So.
No, I'm all in favor of higher education.
All right.
Right.
Fill in the blank.
It's certainly all connected, and today's the day for, I think, trying to think about the good that we can do. So with the Super Bowl coming up this weekend, those comments are probably timely. I don't even know what the Saints colors are. So
I would, if at all possible. We've got two businesses here that have benefited, and if you have the time to listen to them, one's Rob Prince with Pacific Building Systems in Woodburn, and the other is Doug Poyter with Westport Medical right here in Salem. So.
Great, and we actually have both of them signed up, and it looks like we also have Laura Skinner, who traveled from more than 100 miles to get here, so it's our protocol to make sure that she gets in on the next panel as well.
Thank you
very much for being here today and for bringing this information to us. So we'll call Laura Skinner and Doug Poyter and Rob Prince, if all three of you could come forward. And Jack Isselman, you are our other witness, so looks like we might be able to... you don't need to testify. Okay, well, great. Well, then we've got a panel of three and three chairs.
He's going to wait to testify.
Please make yourself comfortable, and whichever one of you would like to go first, please go ahead.
No, go ahead.
Hi, I'm Rob Prince, president of Pacific Building Systems, located in Woodburn. We've been doing business in Woodburn since 1962, so we've been around a long, long time. We have never been able to afford a big piece of equipment that produces a critical element of our building systems. We've always had to purchase that element. It's called purlins and girts. It's a secondary structural member from other vendors. There's only one vendor in this state, and they are so poorly managed, and they've been bought out and bought out and bankrupted and bought out over the last decade and a half so many times. Their management's now in Pennsylvania, even though they were being produced here in Salem. Just a few weeks ago, they pulled up stakes and shipped that machine to Grapevine, Texas. So had we not been able to get this loan and get this machine that produces a part critical to our business, we could have lost 50 jobs. Pretty big deal. Instead, we got a machine. It's a big machine. It's about 6 feet wide, 170 feet long, and it produces these critical elements to our building structures. It provided about four new jobs so far, but that's in this terrible economy. But we just got it up and running this past year, and even in this awful economy, was able to be in the black a little bit. So we're pretty excited. Now that our only competitor has left the country, we should be in good shape. But we appreciate greatly the ability to get this financing and purchase that machine. It made a huge difference in our company and our ability to maintain these jobs.
Thank you. Great comments.
3 years ago, we had a...
And if you could please tell us who you are.
I'm sorry, Chairman Rosenbaum, Vice Chair Telfer, and members of the committee. I'm Doug Poyter. I'm the CEO of Westport Medical. 3 years ago, we had a revolutionary surgical device with FDA approval already. We had meticulously crafted and filed patents for this device. We had clinical evidence and testimonials from the top surgeons in the United States. We had a compelling business plan and a clear path to profitability. What we didn't have was funding for this. We approached as many angel investment groups in Oregon and Washington and Northern California and venture capital groups as we could find to get referrals to. And for nearly a year, we tried to get one of these entities to commit to funding this what looked like a perfect venture. But what we learned was that a majority of these groups that professed to invest in startups actually only do so after a company has achieved profitability or at least is producing units. This is largely, we feel, due to the fallout from the dot-com crash and the consolidation of a lot of the venture groups. And at the point where a company is already producing stuff, the risk is removed from them. So we understand their business model. So knowing this, we decided to pursue other avenues to put together the monies. We were very pleasantly surprised to learn that the state of Oregon was interested in helping us out with a loan in 2008. That $300,000 loan that was extended to us through the OPTF helped far more than just that dollar amount. By doing that, the state, very importantly, took a lead investor role in our company. And that gave enough confidence to Sterling Bank that they extended to us $375,000 of unsecured lines of credit. The combined influence of those two actions allowed us to secure an additional $600,000 of investment from private investors. In 2009, this was our first full year of operation. In the worst economy in 80 years, we sold $268,000 worth of surgical equipment to doctors whose businesses were off as much as 38% nationwide. And they're laying people off. We thank the state of Oregon that they recognized that we had a solid business plan when nobody else would. Thousands of patients have benefited from this device, which is quickly on the path to becoming standard of care. Our direct payroll just last year was $157,000. We had 17 separate 1099s we issued. As sales increased, we continued to hire employees. We spent an additional $290,000 last year between buying component parts and R&D, and the vast majority of that money went to companies in Oregon. That original $300,000 investment is going to be reintroduced into the Oregon economy many times over as our sales volumes increased. The recent banking crisis has made it even more difficult for firms like ours to get funding. So the Oregon Business Development Fund is going to become that much more important until this banking crisis is resolved. Thank you again, Chair Rosenbaum and committee. I'll do my best to answer any questions you might have.
Great, and I think we'll hear from all three of you, and then we'll open it up for questions. Thanks very much. And please go ahead.
Hello, my name is Laura Skinner, and I'm here representing the women of Oregon. I would like to know, for one thing, I would like to know if the state of Oregon, through the governor's office, has met their business protocol that was to have a business, minority business map of women's businesses. I'm wondering about that, if that was supposed to be met in December. And also I'm wondering if you're using any of the money through the recovery program for the minority businesses for Oregon, especially promoting it towards women's businesses. What I have on the table right now is a plan for a transfer station of information going from Kellogg, Oregon, which is up in the mountains, it's next to the Umpqua River, and bouncing communications from that. I've already talked to Douglas Electric. I have all my community setups all done, but that would be bouncing information off that mountain into Reedsport and Florence area and everywhere in between, which right now emergency response people even can't get a good connection through there. And so that's what I'm wondering. I'm wondering about, right now, I found out that women's businesses in our country are 5%. And that's appalling. Because we know that women have the ability and they have everything they need right now to be able to come to the table and to get minority small business loans, but it seems like they're being overlooked. It seems like that for some reason men are getting these loans first. And so I'm wondering if this business model, the map of all the minority women's businesses has been met. The criteria was by December. And if we are looking to promote some of this money towards women's businesses for Oregon. Thank you.
Right, and thank you, Laura, for your comments. We don't actually have the answer to those questions, but presumably we'll be working with the governor's office and the department to ensure that these funds are distributed as equitably as possible, and I certainly share your desire to make sure that we're supporting women-owned businesses, which Oregon certainly has a very high proportion of, and the challenges are there for small businesses generally, and I'm sure your points are well taken. So we've got one more witness, but while we've got these three people in front of us, how about if we open it up for questions? Do we have any questions of these people? Okay, thank you very much for your comments, and thanks for your great stories. And it looks like the last person signed up is Jack Isselman, so if you'd like to come forward. Good afternoon, and welcome to the Commerce Committee.
Thank you, Chair Rosenbaum, members of the committee. For the record, Jack Isselman. I'm appearing before you today on behalf of the Oregon Economic Development Association, but I also bring greetings from Marion Haynes, Vice President of Legislative Affairs for the Oregon Business Association. She had hoped to be here to testify before you, but had a prior commitment that keeps her from here today. I submitted a letter from the Oregon Business Association in support of Senate Bill 1017. The Oregon Economic Development Association is Oregon's only trade association that represents economic development professionals across the state. We have over 200 members, individuals, organizations, and government entities that are on the front lines of business recruitment and retention throughout Oregon. We support the bill that's in front of you. I submitted written testimony. The crux of those remarks are these. The changes you are making are quite helpful to the program, but it's essential if you want to make any meaningful progress towards economic recovery by means of the Oregon Business Development Fund that you fill in that blank. And I've spent, by way of background, I've spent some time at the department. I was the deputy director of the department from 2003 to 2005. I've got a point of view on a number there. I'll share it with you, and we can talk to our good friends down in and Senator Monroe's colleagues down in Ways and Means when we get the opportunity to go there. The program today, the reason I say you have to fill in that blank is the program is oversubscribed. So you can make these changes, but they won't have any impact if we fail to provide additional funding. And obviously we recognize resources are tight, but I think the story that Mr. Prince just related to you from his experience at Pacific Building Systems tells you something about how this fund can be used really to be opportunistic when the marketplace presents unique positioning opportunities for Oregon businesses. And if the liquidity is not there in the fund, then achieving those objectives is challenging, to say the least. So in terms of a number, you could go quite high. We've heard that $16 million extra in the tax amnesty fund. Realistically, I know the department could find transactions easily. Well, let me give you some history. The fund hasn't been recapitalized since 2003. It revolves, which is how it keeps going. And the fact that it hasn't been recapitalized for several legislative assemblies, I think, will impact the kind and type of credit that's extended, because the people who manage it don't know how much string they have left to run out. So a larger recapitalization will give them greater flexibility and opportunity to use funds for a broader range of businesses. It'd be great if some messaging could be sent that they will be recapitalized on some type of a scheduled basis. I think that would make the program a lot easier to administer. But absent that, $10 million of funding is not out of the range of what this fund could use. We put $5 million in it in 2003, and frankly, they've been getting along with the interest that comes back, but they're not able to really dramatically expand the reach of the program. The need is even more acute today because the banks that are traditionally lent to the businesses that participate in OBDF are these small regional banks. They have acute capital impairment that's limiting their ability to lend, and it really creates an even greater need and pressure on funds of this sort to assist small businesses. And you've heard the great stories here today. And I can tell you, throughout our 200 members across the state, there's similar stories of how these loans really either helped save a business that was at a critical gap point in its financing or allowed it to reach new markets in a way it never could in the absence of the resource. So with that, I'll urge you to tell our friends and Ways and Means that we could use a few shekels in the fund here, and I'm happy to take any questions.
Well, and certainly one of your friends, our friends in Ways and Means, is a member of this committee, so he's, I think, hearing these comments loud and clear, and it looks like Senator Monroe might have a reaction.
Jack, do you know what the average repayment time is for these revolving loans? Do you have any idea?
Well, I think my memory is not the best on this. I think it may be prescribed, but you should have John Saris come up, who runs the funds at the department.
Yes, if you have an answer and you want to come forward, please do so.
You know, the reason I ask the question is this kind of a revolving loan fund, a lot of people think that when you allocate money, like whether it's $5 million or $10 million or whatever, that it's spent and gone.
Right.
But in a revolving loan like this, the money comes back and is reused and is reused and is reused, recirculated. I've got a fountain in my backyard, and it's got a little pump on it, and the water just keeps flowing. And a revolving loan fund really works about that way if it's administered properly. And if the loans are lent out that are solvent and sound, that's the way it's supposed to work.
The failure rate, Chair Rosenbaum, Senator Monroe, the failure rate on these loans is incredibly low. It's 1.8%. I mean, if you look at a comparable loan portfolio, you are not going to see a performance rate at that level. I think even in the economic downturn, it's held there. I don't know if there's a statutory cap. John can speak to that. I know the order of magnitude is in the single digits of years. And frankly, they try to make them revolve quicker because they don't know when you guys are going to put more money in, which is not necessarily a good thing to give someone a loan that they're going to have to pay back on a shorter term, depending on the conditions of the business. Mm-hmm. So, but I'll let Mr. Sarah speak to it.
Chair Rosenbaum, members of the committee, for the record, my name is John Saris. I'm the Business Services Manager at Oregon Business Development Department. Senator Monroe, to answer your question, roughly 7 to 8 years for a loan to repay on average, and the fund is actually nearing its fourth complete revolution or turn as far as going out and coming back at this point.
Thank you. To me, this is absolutely public-private partnership at its best.
Thank you, Senator Telfer.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. John, I'm glad you came back up. I do have a question. You know, obviously one of the criteria is businesses have to be bankable. Given the economic situation, you know, I don't, as a CPA, I've got a lot of clients that used to be bankable that are really on the bubble right now. You know, we could put $16 million in there, but if you don't have the demand because businesses are not bankable, I mean, I think, you know, we need to work as to what's a realistic number that will actually go out because there are qualified businesses out there.
Chair Rosenbaum, members of the committee, Senator Telfer, to answer your question, we are actually working on developing some schedules as to, you know, the demand that's out there currently and what we're experiencing based on the economic conditions to help us determine how long funds could appropriately last based on the demand. The demand is increasing. I think what we've seen is that we've seen about 30% of our activity from applications come within the last 60 days. So demand, is continuing to increase, and realistically, it's a matter, we're at a point right now where we're using preference to make sure that we are investing in the best possible opportunities for the state of Oregon in terms of job creation and ability to repay and economic benefit from the fund. So, and one more thing probably to reiterate is that this fund really does depend on our partnership with our financial institutions and our economic development associations across the state. Typically, this fund is leveraged at 4-5:1 with OBDF funds. So a very strong relationship with our financial community.
Yeah, I mean, it's clear when we listen to Doug Porter's story and the Westport story that the way this really worked so well was by having these funds almost like seed money along with private funding sources. So, I realize we're in a different world now, one that none of us has ever seen in our lifetimes, but hopefully by giving some additional flexibility and some additional funds here, that's going to leverage some of that money that's out there that we need to have start flowing back into our small businesses.
And if I may, Chair Rosenbaum and Senator Telfer, to address some of the risk issues, we recognize that this is outside of the box of what has made this program so successful, and that's part of the reason that we feel that the sunset date does have a real material benefit to the program. This is obviously going to further extend and leverage and put more risk with the fund, and so I believe it is wise to at least reflect on it here in the future.
Senator George.
John, I don't know if, thank you, Madam Chair. Did I misunderstand you? You said the average term is 7 to 8 years or turn of the fund. What's the average term of a loan that you have?
Chair Rosenbaum, Senator George, members of the committee, the actual repayment of the loan typically is about 8 years, 7 to 8 years. The term of the loan is going to be based on the depreciable assets that are involved as collateral, working capital, equipment, things of that nature are going to have typically a 5 to 7 year term. Longer term investments like commercial real estate may have a 20-year term associated with them, but there are opportunities that are presented to the companies that have borrowed money to consolidate that debt in the future through restructuring and partnering with their financial institutions. So the loan is paid off through a consolidation or a packaging of the debt that the company does have with the financial institution usually later down the road.
Madam Chair, follow up?
Follow up.
I guess what I'm trying to get at is that obviously, in the last 6 years with Section 179 depreciation, you can match up a little bit better the depreciation schedules with the cash flow situation. And obviously, the state of Oregon is disconnected from that this year. So, obviously, what I worry about is that our depreciation schedules that are outlined in our tax code actually matches with the repayment situation, because then you could put all of these small businesses in a financial pinch if their tax burden doesn't match up with their depreciation schedules and then their loan repayments, because that's clearly what's happening in the capital markets right now. Most of our banks on equipment loans are now talking 3-year loans for assets that you have to depreciate at 7.5 years, which means that between lack of 179 accelerated depreciation and the situation we're having with payments back to the banks, you're putting small business in these huge cash crunch positions. And so I just want to make sure that as we do this, that's kind of an interesting part of what you're proposing here, because in essence what you're doing is matching the term with the depreciation schedule.
Chair Rosenbaum, Senator George, members of the committee, we use the useful life or depreciation of an asset as part of determining the term. The one thing that is nice about the program is that we do have the flexibility to look at that useful life and use that as part of the package for the loan. And in some circumstances, that does make these projects more financeable through our fund as opposed through conventional financing terms. And And, you know, it really must be acknowledged that our partnership with economic development associations such as, you know, So Ready, that have their funds, they have the ability to match what the state is doing in some circumstances. And it's a great tool, and there's some great stories out there of how we've partnered in the past and really helped businesses take it to the next level.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you. I don't see any further questions, so
thank you very much
for that great testimony. I'm going to close, see no one further signed up to testify. I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 1017, and I'll open a work session on Senate Bill 1017. And members, we have all the necessary paperwork in front of us, so I think that we're ready for a motion.
Senator Madam Chair, Helfer. I move that Senate Bill 1017 be moved to Ways and Means with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Telfer has enthusiastically moved Senate Bill 1017
with enthusiasm
to Ways and Means with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion on the motion? Laura, and Senator Prezansky, I believe, is in the Senate President's office right now, so he, for the moment, is excused, but I'm sure he'll want to vote on this when he comes back. So, Laura, would you please call the roll?
Aye.
Senator
Monroe? Aye.
Senator Tucker?
Aye.
Chair
Rosenbaum? Aye. And motion carries, and Senate Bill 1017 moves to the Ways and Means Committee with our heartiest, most enthusiastic due pass recommendation. I'll close the work session on Senate Bill 1017, and we'll have a momentary pause while we get our paperwork in order here. We will open a public hearing on Senate Bill 1045. And, Jim, it looks like we have a staff measure summary. We also have our Labor Commissioner Avakian in the room, who I'm sure will also give us some introductory comments. But would you like to tell us preliminarily what the bill is about?
Brief summary, Madam Chair and members. Senate Bill 1045 prohibits the use of credit history for employment purposes, including hiring, discharge, promotion, and compensation. It provides exceptions for financial institutions, public safety offices, and other bona fide occupational qualification.
Great. Thank you. I do see two elected officials in the audience, and I know that Senator Bonamici also wanted to come back and share some thoughts about this bill. So if Commissioner Avakian, you and Senator Edwards would like to come forward together. And welcome both of you to the Senate Commerce and Workforce Development Committee. I think this is the first time for Senator Chris Edwards, our former House colleague, who's now making himself at home, and we're glad he's here. So, current Commissioner Avakian, please go ahead.
Madam Chair, Senators, In many ways, it's nice to be referred to as a senator again. Enjoyed my time here very much. About 10 minutes ago in the hallway, somebody called me Representative Avakian. Time flies, doesn't it? My name is Brad Avakian. I am the Commissioner of the Oregon Bureau of Labor and Industries. Madam Chair, I appreciate you requesting the Bureau of Labor and Industries to comment on Senate Bill 1045. We are supportive of the efforts in Senate Bill 1045. Part of the mission of the Bureau of Labor is, of course, to enforce the unlawful employment employment practice laws for the state of Oregon, protecting people from unfair action on the job. Another mission of the Bureau of Labor and Industries is to support Oregon's businesses to see that the laws are implemented fairly and that businesses are able, one, to get information about the very complicated state and federal employment laws, but also so that they are able to remain viable with the laws that govern them. Senate Bill 1045 does two things with respect to both those missions. In Section 2, it, of course, provides very strong statement regarding the use of credit histories, making, obtaining, or using for employment purposes an unlawful practice to use credit histories in that manner. We would be the agency that enforces that law. In Section 2, Subsection 2, it also strikes a balance between the need to enforce that law and the need to accommodate various industries. Employers that are federally insured, banks or credit unions, are exempted from the law, as are employers that are required by state or federal law to use credit histories for employment purposes, as are public safety officers, and as are employers that require that kind of information because the information is directly related to a qualification regarding the job that's being applied for. And so we believe that there is a good effort in Senate Bill 1045 to balance the rights of employees with the necessity of businesses to remain viable that need to rely on credit histories. We also understand that discussions continue regarding those list of exemptions and specific language that might be necessary in order to accommodate the needs of Oregon businesses, and the Bureau of Labor remains available to you, Madam Chair, in helping to craft language that creates a good balance between employees and businesses.
Thank you for those comments. And Senator Edwards, please go ahead.
Thank you, Chair Rosenbaum, and members of the committee. My name is Chris Edwards. I'm a state senator in West Eugene, North Eugene, and Junction City, the area that I affectionately like to refer to as the economic hub of Lane County. And I represent thousands of blue-collar workers, white-collar workers, and from the working poor to the middle class. And I also am the former general manager of a small forest products company of about 25 employees, and I bring that experience to this testimony here today. And it's from my experience in that role as in a management role that I know how important the hiring decision is to employers, because it does not matter how proprietary your product, one's product or service, it really is up to good people to make an organization function well. So it's understandably tempting. It would be understandably tempting for an employer to want to know as much about a prospective employee as they possibly could before making that also critical employment decision. But I also believe that some kinds of information are either simply too invasive of the privacy of the individual job applicant or have too little or no predictive value in the job performance to be allowed in the job application process. And I would submit to you that the use of private personal credit information is both of these. With regard to privacy issues, as you know, one's personal credit report, credit history, reveals much about one's spending habits, from whom they bank with to whom their car financing is with. Even as far as revealing to whom one might owe medical bills and to whom one may, to what stores one may have a personal credit account with. And it also tells us a lot about one's payment habits and payment history. And if those habits are less than stellar, there is no explanation as to why perhaps one might be delinquent in their payments, or perhaps one may have filed for bankruptcy. I have a couple of constituents in my district, a young couple with kids, that in, I can't remember if it was 2008 or 2009, but somewhere around in there, they lost their home after their husband, or after the husband of the family, had lost his job due to an, or he had lost his job, he went back to a new job, and then had an injury, not on the job, but wasn't able to work. And after months and months of without work and being able to return to work, the family found themselves in financial difficulty. The wife had a job that was steady, but her hours had been cut back during the economic slowdown. And subsequently, they lost their home, which was the first home, their first home that they had just bought when times were just a little bit better for them. Now, I don't think that it serves anybody's best interest, and it certainly doesn't serve our best interest as society to put up arbitrary barriers to the husband getting back to work when he wants to. And we know that jobs are hard enough to come by as it is. With regard to the relevance, the questionable relevance of this personal private credit information to the employment decision, I would submit to you that this type of information has absolutely no bearing on an employee's ability to show up to work on time, their ability or and willingness to work the extra hours to get the job done, or has anything to do with their skills and knowledge, whether it be in office administrative work or turning a wrench in the mill or swinging a hammer on the construction site. So I really believe strongly that it is in all of our best interest to help those that are unemployed get back to work. And God knows it's hard enough to find work as it is, and we need to remove all the arbitrary barriers to employment that we can. And so for those reasons, I urge your support for this bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Edwards, for those comments. And Senator Bonamici has joined us again. Welcome back. You'll be pleased to know that sent your bill and our bill on its way with a very enthusiastic and hearty DuPass recommendation.
Appreciate that. Thank you. Chair Rosenbaum and committee members, Suzanne Bonamici, State Senator for Senate District 17. Nice to be back. I'm here in support of Senate Bill 1045, the Job Applicant Fairness Act. And I did submit some written testimony, and I will spare you my reading that. But in general, in these times of high unemployment, it's so important for us to do what we can to help Oregonians get back to work. And as I said in the testimony, many people have problems on their credit reports because of things that they really couldn't control. And Senator Edwards was just talking about some of those unexpected medical bills, loss of a job, etc. And I'm going to say something that's not in my written testimony. Several years ago, in one of my prior jobs, I worked at the legal aid office in Eugene, and part of what I did was working with people who were having financial difficulties. They came into the office, legal aid only takes low-income people, but they came in to ask for help. Either they were being pursued by debt collectors, or they were interested in finding out if they needed to file bankruptcy. Many of those people, if not most of those people, were having financial problems not because they overspent. They were having financial problems because they had unexpected medical bills or they had lost a job. Now, that was several years ago, but I can't imagine that things are that much different now. People are having credit problems now, as Senator Edwards was talking about with his constituents, because of the economic downturn. Also, in my testimony, I talk about the accuracy of credit information. I know the credit bureaus do what they can to maintain accurate information. That's their job, and I know that they try the best they can. However, we all have heard about inaccuracies and errors in credit reports. There was a study done several years ago. I couldn't find any updated information, but a significant number of credit reports have errors. Now, the Fair Credit Reporting Act, which is a federal law, allows consumers to correct the information in their credit report, but that process takes time. Time is important. In the meantime, in this economy, somebody could be going without the job. They could be denied a job under current law because of inaccurate information in their credit report. That, to me, is unfair. This bill still allows employers to consider information that's relevant to the job. I noticed that there are several exceptions for those who are applying for work with banks or credit unions, those required by law to use individual credit history or public safety officers, etc. But for those individuals who have negative credit, a negative credit report, primarily because of things that were not their fault, they should not be punished by losing an opportunity to get back to work in these tough times. So I believe that Senate Bill 1045 was crafted to make sure that it protected the rights of employers to ask the questions that they need to ask, but not unfairly punish those who have bad credit. So thank you, Senator Rosenbaum and committee members. I do urge you to support Senate Bill 1045, the Job Applicant Fairness Act, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, and thank you all for your testimony. And so we'll open it up for questions from this panel. Yes, Vice Chair Telfer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This question's to all three of you, and would appreciate an answer. Senator Bonamici's talked about the inaccurate information in a credit report and trying to, you know, correct it. Senator Edwards talks about the relevance. So tell me why we have specific exemptions of the law. What is the relevance? What does somebody do about inaccurate credit report? I mean, why are these people singled out? What's relevant to a specific job? Or how was a potential public safety officer that has inaccurate information? So I kind of ask that to all three of you, as well as Commissioner Avakian.
And I will take a stab at answering your question as the bill's or one of its chief co-sponsors.
I'll have
before
a question
we
for you
open
later.
It up.
Different question.
So I think that you make a good point that obviously there is information that is available currently to employers. This bill doesn't negatively impact all that information that was alluded to, like criminal background checks and employment history and educational history. But to the specific exceptions or the carve-outs in this bill, and obviously this is an initial hearing, but we talked about this somewhat at the informational hearing that you weren't able to have with us. There are other states that have laws on the books currently similar to the one presented in Senate Bill 1045, and in those cases, they have identified that there are certain situations, obviously if this information is required to be obtained by law, and we do have cases where we have done that, we can't negatively impact that. I think there's been a general consensus that people in certain occupations, particularly involving handling money or confidential information, and in addition, certain law enforcement officials, too, have come forward, and in other states been identified. So that really is where those exceptions come from. And there is, as you see, I think on lines 17 through 21 of the bill, a much broader section that doesn't name specific types of employment situations, but does create an additional exception. But that's my initial stab at it, but I'll certainly open it up to the
panel.
Well,
let me be a little
answers.
Bit clearer. What I'm looking for is, why is somebody working at a bank different than somebody working at a CPA firm that's dealing with cash and people's credit card information and proprietary information? I guess, you know, I'm looking for some specifics.
Senator Rosenbaum and Senator Telfer. I would believe, and Senator Rosenbaum is the principal sponsor of the bill, I think worked more on the language in the exemptions. I would believe that if there would be a concern about the information in, for example, a CPA firm, that there may be an argument under the catch-all paragraph there. But that's just my interpretation from looking at the bill. If there is a concern about access to financial information and it's analogous to the banks and the credit unions, I believe that would fall under the subparagraph D.
So I think that's one answer. I also would just point out, and Commissioner Avakian mentioned this at the outset, and I think we'll hear shortly from witnesses who have questions about exactly what you're raising, that we have discussions that have been ongoing about the language in that particular section of the bill, and I think we'll be, as we're in a public hearing now and as we're moving forward, we're looking for proactive suggestions or problems that can be identified. So Commissioner Avakian, looks like you had a comment.
I was just going to add that, Madam Chair and Senator, that certainly it's a policy decision, the scope of exemptions or not for the body, but it's not unusual in employment law for the state to recognize the historic or traditional roles of particular industries when they have a pattern. And some of these that are listed here, the public safety officers, the banks, the credit unions, do have a strong historical use of credit reporting in their hiring. And I think it would be consistent with other areas of employment law if you chose to use these exemptions to do it on the basis of that historical use of reports.
Yes, Senator George.
Thank you.
And we do have another legislator I see who has joined us, so we will certainly, if you're here to testify, Representative Hoyle, we will get to you shortly.
Great. I appreciate all of you, and Commissioner, I'm sorry I missed your testimony, but I have some of the same concerns that Senator Telfer has, which is either it's helpful information, so it should be applied to everybody, or it's not helpful information, and everybody should be exempted from it. And there's a little bit of inconsistency there. But, Commissioner, I'd like to ask you a specific question about how this could work practically in somebody's office. Let's say, for instance, I hire a person to come in and man my front desk. Clearly, under this scenario, I cannot do a credit check on them. I do the best I can as far as background checks go, but really former employers have gone bankrupt, or former employers don't like to talk about who worked, or it's hard to do some background right now just by calling references up. But I give the person the job, and I decide that I'm going to promote them to an accounts receivables position, which probably is in the catch-all. I could do a background check. I mean, I could do a credit check on them. During that credit check, I find out that they completely made up everything on their resume, because in the credit check, it gives me all their former employers, gives me a whole series of information where they had lied on their original application to get the first job. I discharge them because of the fact of the information I found on the credit report prove that they lied to me in their initial application to me where they got the first job. As I read this, I would be forced to keep that employee even though I knew they lied to me during the application process completely and while they're on the job. Is that the way you read this, between the way Section 2.1 reads and who I could apply the credit report to? Because it seems like to me you're in a catch-22 if you want to move somebody up internally in your company.
Strict reading of subsection 1 says that information contained in the credit history that you obtained could not be used for the purpose that you state. Certainly, if you had knowledge of that and spoke with the employee about it and the employee verified that the information was true, I think you would then also be getting information from the employee that you could then act on. So if you had the same information from another source, the simple fact that you first got it in the credit history, I don't think would preclude you from taking action.
Well, Madam Chair, if I could.
Senator George, did you have a follow-up question?
Yeah, I do. Is it possible for us to possibly change this bill a little bit? Because it seems like to me that once I hire somebody and they're in staff, I'm not going to be doing credit checks on them. But if I want to promote them and they're moving into a position where a credit check is appropriate according to the bill, appropriate and I find out information, I should be able to discharge them if I found out that they've been lying to me the entire time. Do you understand what I'm saying? It seems like to me we could change this fairly easy in this bill because it seems like a pretty big loophole. A lot of companies promote internally, and if you found out through that process, through the credit check process, I think we could catch up a lot of employers in a lot of trouble here, and it might block people from moving up in their own companies.
Madam Chair and Senator, I understand the concern you're bringing up. From an enforcement standpoint at the Bureau of Labor, I think it would become very difficult to put us in the position of having to decipher once you request a credit report and then have information not only like you described but also the credit rating on what information the employer is really being motivated to take the action against the employee. So from an enforcement standpoint, it becomes a very difficult evidentiary issue, and I think precluding the use of the report is the easiest way to resolve that.
And I also want to point out, Senator George, and we'll have plenty of time to discuss this, that there's nothing in this bill which would deny any employer of any sort the ability to access the information in an employment report that deals with work history, criminal background history, educational background. So the first scenario that you described where somebody just lied on their job application, it's actually not the credit information that really, even if it were accurate, which I think we'll hear some testimony, it's not always accurate, but that it's not really the credit information that you're looking at to find out did somebody really have the PhD that they said they had or did they work at these three places they said. I mean, you still have access to what the reports are that contain that information. So, yeah, I think that should be pointed out. Okay, so I don't see any other...
Wanted to... Senator Edwards was unable to or didn't get to answer the question, so I want to be a little bit more clear because I... Subsection D, or Section 2, Sub D, is pretty broad. As far as the catch-all that says, well, you can do it if. But so relevance and historical use isn't necessarily relevant. It's just something that's always been, we always have a meeting Tuesday, so let's have a meeting Tuesday. So I'm not a supporter of historical use. So give me an example, Senator Edwards, as to why it is relevant for a public safety officer, potential candidate, to have a credit check done versus somebody else.
Well, Madam Chair, Senator Telfer, I support the bill. I didn't draft the bill, so I don't know what the discussion was that went behind that. But I would imagine that as we have a public discussion, a public policy discussion about what professions should be exempted and what should not, there would come to the forefront certain professions in which the public trust, in which public trust is at a premium, and in those cases, in which public trust is at a premium, and you may be able to make a nexus between credit history and the job function. So I don't know what the discussions were as far as public safety officers are concerned. I certainly can understand why the public would not feel comfortable with the situation in which somebody with bad credit is giving them perhaps financial advice in a banking situation. I mean, there's a disconnect there, and so I think that all of these things are, I mean, that's why we're having this public hearing, to flush out those issues and make it a good bill.
Oh, thank you. I mainly asked you the question on relevance because you used it in your testimony, and it's kind of like my grandmother always said, practice what I preach, not what I do. So it's possible that a banker could give you good financial advice and they have terrible credit. But
yes, Bernie Madoff certainly always comes to mind when that topic comes up. I'd say maybe the converse of what you just said. Yes, Senator Bonamici, did you have a comment?
No, thank you.
Okay, I don't see any more questions for this panel. Commissioner Vakian, I know you've been here all day, but if you can possibly stay in the room for a little while longer in case other questions come up, that would be great. So thank you, and I do see Representative Hoyle has joined us too. Are you here to testify?
I am.
And so please come forward. And I think I'll also call a couple more witnesses. We don't have a huge list, but we have quite a few people, and the hour's getting late. So I'm going to try to call people in panels and maybe alternate so that we have some opponents and then some supporters. So if Mary Botkin is still here, if you want to come forward, and Henry Kramer, and then but Representative Hoyle, please go ahead.
Val Hoyle, representative from House District 14, West Eugene, Junction City, Cheshire, and Alvador. And I'd like to thank you, Chair Rosenbaum, Vice Chair Telfer, and members of the Commerce and Workforce Development Committee for hearing my testimony. I submitted written testimony, but what I wanted to speak to you about was some real-life experiences. When I'm not being a representative, I'm the director of the United Way of Lane County's Healthcare Access Initiative. So we deal with people in our community who need to find access to affordable health care, much like Health Matters in Bend that Senator Telfer has been so active in working on. And in my district, the average income is $28,000, and we've had people that have lost jobs, and they have fallen into a situation where there aren't other jobs for them, good family wage jobs that have gone away. And when they lose their jobs and they're on unemployment, things start spiraling out of control. These are people who always paid their bills, who have been very responsible. The other people I deal with are people who have unexpected health problems. Previous to this recession, the number one cause of bankruptcy was because of health care bills. Now, my very own mother, she had a good job. Job got shipped offshore. She didn't have health insurance, had a very bad accident. She had an exceptionally good credit rating up until she ended up in the hospital. She lost her home. She lost her savings. She lost her credit rating and had to declare bankruptcy. Now, she does now have a job, but it was difficult for her to find a job. And if someone were to just look at her credit history, they'd say this is an irresponsible person. But she is not. She's like so many Americans who didn't have access to insurance and wasn't able to keep up. I have another client who is a 38-year-old mortgage banker who had a stroke, massive stroke at 38. And for a year he was working to get his skills back. And so when he came back to go to work, obviously his credit rating was very bad. He had been in rehabilitation for a year. Did he have skills? Yes, he did. But if we look under the current practice, someone would judge him strictly by his credit rating. And I think that we should judge people on their abilities, on their history, on their job experience, and their ability to do the job. I think we're in a very different time where a credit rating doesn't really tell you as much as it did previous to this recession when people could find employment and, again, when people had access to health care. So I would just encourage you to support this because it's fair, it's right, and it gives people opportunities to get back to work, and that is the most important thing we can do. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony.
May I interrupt for just a moment? Representative Powell, we do not have written testimony from you. If you could get that to me, the committee administrator, Jim Stembridge, we'd be happy to distribute it to the members and make it part of the committee record.
I apologize for that. I thought it happened, but thank you.
It might be on my desk upstairs. I'm not sure.
Right. It's been a bit of a hectic day for us with three bills to get ready for. So, but thank you for your comments. And Representative Hoyle, you would be welcome to join us at the dais if you wanted to hear some of the testimony or.
Chair Rosenbaum, thank you very much, but I have to get back to the Health Care Committee.
Well, I understand how that goes. So thanks very much for being here.
Thank you so much.
Okay, please go ahead.
Chair Rosenbaum, members of the committee, my name is Henry Kramer. I'm the political director of the Bus Project, and we work to engage young people and new people in our democratic process, and today I'm speaking in favor of Senate Bill 1045, and particularly in terms of how it affects young Oregonians. Like most Oregonians, young people are really suffering in the economy. According to the Oregon Employment Department, Oregonians age 35 are at a 15.3% unemployment rate. Oregonians under 25 are at a 21.3% unemployment rate. You can compare that to the already too high number of all Oregonians, which is 11.3%, I believe, which I'm sure you guys have burned into your minds. As we do our best to get the few jobs that there are out there, we're currently holding rising debts that are,
in some cases larger than our bank accounts, and taking a huge toll on our credit history. You know, the average college graduate is coming out of school with about $20,000 in debt. The average young adult with a credit card debt has about $9,000 in debt. And the average 18 to 24-year-old pays about 30% of their income in service to their debt, or service on their debt, which is about three times the recommended ceiling, the percentage of your income to pay toward service on your debt. And certainly debt holders, you know, share a lot of the responsibility in that, but a great deal of it also falls on credit card companies, which are preying on young people to greater and greater degrees. A lot of us are getting dozens of credit card applications per year, and we're all but chased down on a lot of college campuses. And this is the toxic job environment plus this unprecedented debt is, you know, reaping havoc on our credit histories. The average 18 to 24 year old bankruptcy rate has doubled over the last 10 years, and that number comes before the recession. So I have no idea what it is at now, but my guess is it's higher. Young people now have the second highest rate of bankruptcy, just under folks 35 to 44. And while this economy is putting an entire generation of Oregonians in financial peril, it's pretty maddening to see companies put more impediments in front of getting a job for qualified people. There's no statistical correlation, I believe you've already heard, between a person's credit history and their ability to perform a job well, or their propensity to commit fraud. Even so, over 2 in 5 businesses are using this practice, and it's keeping qualified people from getting jobs. Just want to give one example. Joshua Norwood, who's a 27-year-old a newlywed who lives in Malala, has been unemployed since he moved back to Oregon with his wife. He's been doing his best to find work. He applied to be a clerk in a convenience store in Oregon City. His first interview went well. The manager liked him. His second interview went great. And they began putting him on the schedule pending a criminal background check and a credit check. His criminal background check came back clean, and he was told he had the job pending the credit check. Once his credit check came back, he lost the job. He'd been unemployed since he came back to Oregon, and with very little financial assistance had been racking up a little bit of debt on his credit card. And like countless others, his unemployment cost him his job. And he asked me to share this story to stop this practice from happening in Oregon. His story is not uncommon, but it's a good example of how widespread this practice is. It's hard for me to imagine what Josh's credit history has to do with his capacity to provide good customer service at a convenience store. Credit check screens are hurting the people most who are feeling this recession hardest. And we need to change that and help Oregonians get back to work. So to help those folks most in need, the bus project urges you to pass Senate Bill 1045. Thank you very much. Happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Please go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, I'm Mary Byfe. I'm here today representing the American Federation of State, County, Municipal Employees. And I guess with Duke's absence, I'm also speaking for the AFL-CIO this afternoon. I feel, you know, sort of awestruck at being able to speak for everybody in the labor movement. But I will limit my testimony to those folks that we represent. We have people who are working in very hard jobs around the state. Many of our members work in the prison system. And as individuals working in the prison system, they are considered public safety officers. And we would urge you to delete that section of the bill, which exempts them. And I will tell you why. Public safety officers, by and large, are those individuals who are currently being deployed to Iraq and Afghanistan and places where there seems to be a war occurring. When they are deployed, their families are left with military pay as opposed to corrections officer pay. And when that occurs, amazingly enough, the family is left in poverty. Now, we have done some things to try and assist those officers who are serving in military service and have been deployed, by allowing other officers to donate time to help offset the loss in salary. But too often what we see is a deterioration of their ability to continue, the family's ability to continue to hang on to the standard of living to which they had become committed to. We have seen families lose their homes, And with that comes a bad credit history. I would suggest that if we want to eliminate their ability to hold their job because of their credit history or because of a bad credit report, perhaps we should also not permit them to fight in Afghanistan or Iraq and bring them home, which I'm sure would be preferable to them as well. Having said that, you know, generally we support this bill. We don't support the carve-out of public safety officers. We see no correlation between their credit history and their ability to protect this country or this state or their community. We don't see any correlation between their credit history and their ability to shoot straight if they're a police officer or a Marine or an Army individual in the Army. We also represent an amazing amount of women who are barely getting by. Recent studies show that in my 25 years in the labor movement, we have managed to claw our way up from 59 cents on the dollar to a little over 70 cents on the dollar for what men make. And now I find out that some of our employers are using credit history as an excuse not to offer promotion or transfers for people into better job opportunities in public service. This makes no sense to me. I'm just going to reiterate what everybody else has said. Those decisions should be based on skills and ability and work history, not on your ability to make your ends meet in tough economic times. And this just makes it worse. And I can't imagine how awful this would be for our officers who are working inside the prison system or in the line of duty as public safety officers. That exemption needs to go away.
So I'm going to ask people to hold. We do want to get to some of the opponents of the bill as well, and they've been waiting really patiently. Did you have a really
interesting question?
Okay, Senator George.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yeah, I agree with you, Mary. I actually do. I find Section 2, Subsection 2, A and C, redundant to D, meaning it seems like to me that if you took out public safety officers, a person could still argue that they went under the exemption under D. And, Henry, as I read the bill, your friend Josh would be caught up still, even if this bill passed, the convenience store could still do, because he handled money, as I read D, they could still do a credit check on him because of the exemption that's in D. So I think we have a structural problem here, because what's happened is A, which is insured banks and credit unions and public safety officers, are sort of redundant to D, and then D is all-encompassing, so I'm not sure it takes care of your friend Josh in that situation. So that's sort of a comment. I don't know if you guys want to respond to it. And then the other thing is, Josh, is that we also have a lot of young people who have been really frugal with their dollars, and it would be a good reflection on them. And I hate for them not to get a job, even though they've been more frugal than other folks. But I think you have a structural problem in the exemptions, just my opinion.
And Senator George, I don't think either of these witnesses participated in crafting this bill, so I would be happy to meet with you and discuss the
just sort of an observation for everybody that I'm not sure your
testimony anything else that you see
applies.
But
to
I really do want to get to some of the opponents who've been waiting to. So, unless you had something you needed to say, okay. Thank you very much. And because J.L. Wilson has been waiting so patiently and has been with us from the very beginning of our hearing, I'll call him next, and also Pam Levitt and Cindy Robert. Cindy, you're still here.
Madam Chair, while we're waiting, we have testimony from three other individuals we'll put on the record. I just wanted to mention it. This is from Representative Kotek, from Phil Lesh, and from Unite Here. organization.
And so we have that written testimony in front of us, and a note was also just handed to me that Representative Hoyle had actually provided written testimony at our January 12th informational hearing, which I know Senator Telfer was not here for, and I don't think Senator Przanski was here either. So
I'll just go in and retrieve that and make that an exhibit.
We can collect some of
the
written testimony that was provided at the first hearing and make sure that people...
What was the third one, Jim?
It's Unite Here. I'll make sure you have a copy of it. I don't think you have a copy of it. We will get you a copy and put it into the record of the committee proceedings as well.
I have the other two.
Great. Okay, well, sorry for shuffling papers in front of you, but have you decided which one of you would like to go first?
It's me. Thank you, Chair Rosenbaum. Members, for the record, J.L. Wilson representing Associated Oregon Industries. I want to make clear we're opposed to Senate Bill 1045 as introduced, but we are very open to finding language that would make it workable for business. My overall concern with regard to our employers, and I think the statistics bear this out, about half of our employers are using credit checks as part of the employment decision-making process, that our members have the tools they need to make proper decisions with regard to what we call positions of trust. Those positions with access to company assets, cash, client assets, clients' personal information, financial information, et cetera. Those that are in a position of trust within the company that have purview over very sensitive things. The criticisms of the bill dealing with the exemptions, the carve-outs, I think Senator George hit it on the head. I mean, at first blush, we're concerned why exemptions would be granted specifically to financial institutions and public safety officers, both presumably because they have that access to assets and data and personal information, when thousands of private sector employees have that same access to that same situation, but they won't be covered under this bill. And to get to Senator Telfer's point, the biggest criticism we have to the bill, and we would focus our attention here on Section 2, Sub 2D, with regard to the bona fide occupational qualifications, the BFOQs, and whether they really have the applicability you think they have, whether they really apply to real-world situations. And I have a real-world situation in my written testimony to you in the form of an IT worker who would have administrator-level access, which means they have access to passwords and all the data on the servers, including credit card information and vendor accounts and the ability to tamper with someone's identity. These are all significant dangers, but under the bill, under the BFOQ section on Section 2, Sub 2D, a credit check on that worker would not be permitted because you'd have to show it was a bona fide occupational qualification. And for an IT worker, a BFOQ might be an ability to run an SQL server or .NET programming, but it wouldn't be anything pertaining to what's in a credit history. You talk about, is it necessary to the operation of the employer's business? Again, it would be almost impossible to show meet that burden of proof in this instance of an IT worker. And the third test in Section 2D is the information in the credit history. Does it have a substantial relationship to the functions and responsibilities of the position to which the BFOQ applies? And again, under this standard, you could not make the connection between an IT worker who, again, has direct access to very, very personal information, company assets. They would not be able to meet this test. And so this is a real-world situation in which subsection 2D would not work, and we would, in fact, make the argument that it would be in everyone's best interest that an employer has the ability to have information on this employee. Another concern with how Senate Bill 1045 may impact a common business practice, an employer may take out a business insurance policy that provides for coverage for losses resulting from employee dishonesty or fraud, and for underwriting purposes, the employer may be required by the carrier to provide credit data on this employee, and such a requirement probably would not meet the subsection 2D test. And finally, I would just put this out there also, it is worth noting that the use of credit reports in connection with employment is regulated by the FTC currently under the Fair Credit Reporting Act. Again, to get back to that BFOQ qualification in Section 2, Sub 2D, that's really the language that concerns us the most. It needs to have more real-world applicability. The standards in it are such are just They're just too narrow. It wouldn't get to the people that are really important positions of trust within our companies, and that's what we'd like to focus on.
Okay, thank you, JL, for those comments. And whoever would like to go next, please go ahead.
Chair Rosenbaum, members of the committee, Pam Levitt with the Credit Union Association of Oregon. You have my written testimony that really outlines kind of our comments and suggestions on moving forward. We have two areas of concern to us with this bill, and certainly understand the goals of the proponents of the bill. And I just want to, after hearing your comments and questions earlier, I want to make it clear we weren't involved in writing this bill, so we did not carve out our own exemption. You may be wondering why she is here when she has an exemption. The first question to us is we have organizations called CUSOs, Credit Union Service Organizations. They're for-profits affiliates of our members, and they do handle very sensitive and private member information. And so we would need to have some language that cares for the affiliate affiliate companies of credit unions. We think that certainly can be fixed if this bill is moving forward with amendments. The second issue of concern also kind of relates to a little bit of what JL was talking about. And we have federal requirements, and I gave you kind of those information on vendor due diligence. For example, if we have a credit union has a document storage company or a document destruction company as one of our vendors, the federal government, through our federal regulatory structure, is going to analyze, are we doing due diligence to protect member information? And if there was an identity theft or identity breach with one of those members and we didn't have the opportunity to do a credit check with some of the leadership in those organizations, the federal government would come back and look at that. So we're very interested in our federal requirements on vendor due diligence. Now, I want to make it clear, those requirements do not say we have to do a credit check. But they do say that they want it to be consistent with what you do at the credit union, and so it's certainly an option that our members would like to have. And so in looking at the catch-all section, our attorneys don't feel that the catch-all section in line 17 through 21 really captures the language that we would need. And so we hope that if this bill is moving forward that we could work with you on language that would be acceptable. Thank you.
Great. Thank you. Go ahead.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Cindy Robert, and I represent NACM Oregon. It's an affiliate of National Association of Credit Management. We've been serving clients in Oregon, Southwest Washington, and Idaho for over 110 years, and our work includes credit reports, educational courses, account management, and collection services for 970 corporations in Oregon, from your smallest businesses to your high-tech businesses, to from your Boyd's Coffee all the way to your Bonneville Power. I have two thoughts that I want to put before you to think about. First of all, I haven't heard much here about it, but I think the thing that's very important, at least from my client's point of view, is the assumption, which I hope we all have, that businesses and employers act responsibly, not only with private information they get, but when they need that private information. 50% of my members use employee checks, but they're only for employees, potential employees that they think are in a position of trust that need them. And then the information is treated with the utmost of privacy. Much of the information I've heard here makes me feel like there's a lack of trust on businesses' basis here in Oregon. Secondly, I keep hearing about in these times, in this down economy, with what's going on with the economy and the health crisis, it is a bad time. But the bill is very specific. It's about credit history. Not credit score, not credit slice and time, not what your credit's been in the last 3 months. It's your credit history. And the employers we're working with are looking for patterns. They believe that sometimes irresponsibility in your own personal finance may translate to irresponsibility in your business. We simply ask you to consider those two things. I think it's valuable to assume that businesses in Oregon want to do the right thing. I think it's valuable to make sure that we look at, at history. They're not looking at one piece and trust that our businesses are doing it the right way. Finally, I did want to say that I did have one of my members say to me, you know, there's very few things that I can look at that are going to tell me about the character of someone I'm interviewing. And I get a lot of people responding to every job application. You can call the references, but they've already talked to those people. You can call their past employers, but these days in Oregon, the past employers can't tell you anything except for the dates they worked there. It's very hard for them to get a sense of who that person is. And this particular employer told me, if I can't do it, and I got 100 applicants, and I can't look at anything that shows not what's happened since there's been a crisis, not what's happened since they moved, not what's happened since they got sick, since everybody knows that the score is going to look at, but their history of how they behaved. If I can't look at that and learn a little bit about that person and be expected to use that responsibly, I'm going to hire people I know. So where we may be trying to make the pool of applicants bigger by making sure people aren't shut out, his concern was this makes the pool of applicants smaller because he's not going to interview people that he does not know. I just ask you to consider those things. Thank you.
Well, thank you for your comments. And I guess I would just speak for myself. I can't speak for anyone else on the dais, but certainly there's nothing in the bill that is intended to suggest that employers have anything other than a strong desire to be good partners, as we heard in earlier testimony on other bills. You know, we are in a really dire economic situation in our nation and in Oregon with massive unemployment, with high rates of small business failures. I think some of the employees we're talking about are themselves business owners who are now out there on the job market, who in some cases have been unable to get lines of credit, gotten in trouble on their credit cards because, as we heard in earlier testimony on the small business loan program, a lot of employers have had to simply use their credit cards to keep their businesses going. So I guess I would just ask you, Cindy, you know, why would we want to penalize hardworking Oregonians, no matter, you know, in what walk of life, because they might have been victims of this recession that I would probably warrant everybody in this room knows somebody who's lost a job, who's had to deal with bad circumstances and is still out there trying to get by, trying to get back to work, trying to, you know, keep their business going if they're a business owner. So, I mean, I guess maybe this is a rhetorical question to you, but there certainly is nothing that I've heard today that suggests that we're trying to something harmful.
Madam Chair, I talk so much I even answer rhetorical questions. But I did want to say that I understand that no one here is trying to hurt business, and neither is, or say that business doesn't do things right, and neither is the bill. It's some of the anecdote that makes me feel a little bit that way. But you bring up a really good point. It is a bad time. This is not a good time. The economy stinks. But again, it's a pattern. It's a history. It's not a just now thing. And you say, well, why should we have employers do this and treat people unfairly? I don't believe they do. I had one of my clients who said that that they actually had someone who, there were five people in the pool. One person had bad credit score, credit time right now, but he didn't have bad credit history in their minds because that person had showed that they had made an effort to work with their creditors. So if you're spending a lot of money on your credit card to stay above ground, and God knows a lot of us have been there before, if you're having to do that, that doesn't make you have poor credit. What makes you have poor credit is not paying anything on a bill and not paying attention or taking calls and trying to figure out a system that works. Doing poorly, making no money, having to feed your family does not make you have a bad credit score, not now and not in the past. It makes it so that you have to show that you're doing something to work it out. It can show responsibility as much as it can show irresponsibility.
So, other questions for these witnesses? Looks like people are wearing out. I guess I also wanted to comment to JL and to Pam that I really appreciate you making proactive suggestions. I know that JL has spent some time in my office over the last several days with suggestions for ways to improve the bill, and I'm sure that we will continue to have dialogue on that point. So certainly, you know, any ideas for how this bill could be made workable and improve it are very welcome.
Madam Chair, if it's okay, we may suggest some conceptual amendments to your office.
So. That would be great. Okay. Well, thank you all for being here. It looks like we're getting down to our last couple of people signed up, and members, we're going to, I think we'll be able to wrap up by 5:30, which is the time we're set to adjourn. Angela Martin, I think, is still here, and John Powell was signed up.
He's here.
He is here. Okay, if you could both come forward. And I believe the only other person signed up was Duke Shepherd, and we were told he had to leave for another meeting. So. Good afternoon. Thanks for waiting so patiently. And whichever one of you would like to go first, please do so.
Chair Rosenbaum, members of the committee, for the record, Angela Martin with Our Oregon. I provided testimony on your January 12th hearing and included written testimony that was submitted, so I really want to spend my few moments here addressing some of the issues that have been raised and answer any questions that you may have. We've all heard that now more than ever, Oregonians need help getting back to work. At the same time, now more than ever, employers need help finding and using tools that will help them evaluate the 100-plus applicants that apply for now any open position. One of the arguments that we make is that this tool that has been developed and marketed by credit reporting agencies is not an effective tool for employers. It is also not a fair tool for the employees. Why is it an ineffective tool? First, we look at the error rates. 2007 Zogby poll is the most recent data I was able to pull. 37% of people who pulled their own credit report responded found errors. 50% of those individuals had serious difficulties correcting those errors. Correcting the error can take as much as 30 days, and if you are that 50% that weren't able to correct them, it can take even longer, including legal action. What's happening during that period of time that you're working to correct those errors? Again, one in four people with errors are applying for that job could have errors on the report. The position is not held open. There is not a grievance process or an opportunity for you to go back to that employer and say, actually, I do have strong credit. That information was inaccurate. The Fair Credit Reporting Act sets up rules and federal guidelines that address accuracy and access. It does not address what to do in the fast-paced job application process. The Fair Credit Reporting Act, I would submit, was not developed to address those very timely needs of job applicants. The other thing that I want to touch on in my testimony is the direct impact this has had and the stories that have come to my attention. I submitted a sheet of paper with a few stories. I want to highlight one of those. April, a woman who asked me to leave her last name off because of how difficult this has been for her, comes from Beaverton, Oregon, shared her story with us that over the last 2 years, her and her husband have gone back and forth about from being unemployed. They moved to Oregon because her husband had a good job opportunity. It took her almost a year to find a position. The moment she found a job, her husband was laid off. That, of course, has had a damaging impact on their credit report. Her husband struggled for more than a year to find a position. He finally was hired on or told that he would be accepted for a position pending all of his background checks. The Human Resources Department came back and said that he had failed his credit report. And therefore would not be hired. The hiring manager called him up, apologized, said that he had gone to bat for him and tried to make the case that this was still the best employee, but to no avail. He was his hiring manager was overridden by the HR department. This has had a devastating impact on their family. He moved back to Alaska, and as she explains, she has not seen him more than 22 days since last March. This is really an opportunity to help the greatest number of people. I know that there'll be conversations moving forward on how we deal with these exemptions, and that's something that can be addressed. But the vast majority of employees that are going for these positions need every assistance they can to remove these barriers that are before them so they can start paying their bills, start repairing their credit, and start getting back to work. As I said, I've submitted written testimony. I'll end my oral comments here and open it for questions.
Okay, let's hear from the whole panel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Please. My name is John Powell. I'm before you representing two clients today. One is GTEC Corporation, which is a vendor that provides lottery services to lotteries across the country, including in Oregon. And the other is the Oregon State Sheriff's Association. First, from the GTEC perspective, they are required by the Oregon State Police to do credit, among other investigations, of potential employees who work around the lottery to do background checks, which includes credit check. And you can imagine the importance of people who even do wiring and things like that on lottery machines, the importance of the integrity of that system. The language in the law that says employees that are required by state or federal law, I think that particular language, I think we're within the intent of that, but I don't think the law specifically requires that. I think it's an agency of the government that requires that check. So we would need, I think, some change in the wording there. The language below, which talks about substantial relationship to the functions and responsibilities, again, the credit, if somebody is wiring machines together for the purpose of the transactions they do, that would not, their credit would not have a direct impact upon that work, but it would be necessary, again, in order to satisfy the state police requirements of background investigations. So I think they're caught in just the terminology here, not necessarily the intent. So we'd be glad to work with the committee in that regard. On behalf of the Oregon State Sheriff's Association, on line 16 of the printed bill, the reference there to public safety officers only contains a reference to, quote, full-time employees, and I think we would need a different reference there. Many times people enter law enforcement, in some cases by actually volunteering, and then on a part-time basis and then to a full-time basis. So I think we just need a definition there that would include folks that are not full-time. Thank you.
Okay. Well, helpful comments. Are there any questions for these witnesses? Yes, Senator Telfer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. A question for Angela, I think it is. Is there anything under current law that precludes a potential employee in an interview process to inquire of the potential employer, will credit reports be used? If so, having the opportunity to explain the inaccuracies that they're going to see? I mean, is there anything that precludes right now a potential employee explaining their credit history to a potential employer?
Chair Rosenbaum, Senator Telfer, let me answer that by first explaining again what the law requires an employer to do when they pull a credit report. First, they require the employee or the job applicant to provide permission. I've seen many of the applications, it's more of a blanket permission. You're giving permission to pull, look at my background. The people that we speak to don't often understand, is that just criminal or a credit check? So it would require some clarification, you know, very specific conversation. The second federal requirement is that if they use pull the report and any information in that report influences that hiring decision, they have to send a letter of adverse action to the employee. Again, there's no requirement that the employee gets an opportunity to respond. They get an opportunity to connect with the credit reporting agency and correct any errors or look at what's in there. So there isn't a door open for that applicant to have a dialogue with that employer.
Follow up. Go ahead. So that means that if an employee is sitting there during an interview process, they cannot offer corrections to their credit report prior to even the credit report being pulled?
Chair Rosenbaum, Senator Telfer, I wouldn't presume to say that there's a law that...
That's fine. So they could. They could correct things. You do it all the time when you go in for a bank loan and you say, well, here's what you're going to find in my credit report. Here's a history or whatever, and they can explain it away since it takes so much effort to try to fix the inaccuracies that are in your credit reports these days.
Chair Rosenbaum, Senator Telfer, wouldn't that depend on when they pull that report? The employer may well be pulling that report after the in-face interview. The example that I offered you in the story right here, the gentleman had gone through the formal interview process. The hiring manager, the department manager that would have to work one-on-one, made the decision that we like this employee and how they will fit into our department. It was then passed on to HR, who didn't do an in-person interview, but instead did a procedural check on criminal and credit. And at that point, the hiring decision was rescinded, and there was no opportunity for them to say their piece.
I apologize for not asking the question very clearly, but
did you get...
No.
What you're looking for? Okay. Well, no. Senator Przanski has another question, so maybe
that
will get at it.
Clarification. What I'm hearing, because, I mean, I can't think of the last time I've done a personal credit check. And if you have someone making the application to go to work at a firm and they give them that right, a lot of that stuff could actually have been done after the interview process. And you may not even know what's showing up unless someone says, you're being denied this employment because you have these problems. They may not even know there's an inaccuracy on the credit report. That's what I think I'm hearing.
Chair Rosenbaum, Senator Przanski, that's certainly what we hear from individuals, that they don't understand. It was too late. It was beyond that conversation that they got to have with the hiring manager. It happened after the fact.
And I think as a practical matter, too, you know, there is that whole discussion about the accuracy of these reports, but I think a big part of the discussion that we've heard today, and I'm sure will continue, is that there are lots and lots of people who, through circumstances, you know, life circumstances, even in good times, have credit reports that are less than stellar. And certainly, in the worst economy since the Great Depression, in a time where people are struggling to pay their bills and to keep afloat, it would be highly surprising if there weren't a high number of people, and we know there are, who actually do have unpaid bills and outstanding accounts. And I think the debate that we're having here, which has been a healthy debate, is whether that information should be something that keep somebody from getting a job to pay the very bills that they need a job in order to be able to, you know, have a better credit report. And that, I think, is part of the purpose of this bill. And I see that Senator George has got a question. Does it have to do with very young people who have not yet got any credit?
No, not at all, actually.
At all?
No. Thank you, Madam Chair. As I always appreciate when you come in, you're always one of the most prepared witnesses, and your knowledge actually kind of got an idea in my head. It seems like to me that the problem here is that the person signs a blank sort of approval for somebody to pull their background check and a credit check. And sometimes they don't recognize that actually could mean a credit check, and I think that point you made was excellent, because that's probably really true. Question to you is that what happens, I mean, what if rather than saying we're going to prohibit these, because I think the language is going to be very difficult to draft up, what if we mandated that employers who actually pull credit checks have a separate sheet that says it's credit check only, and then give the potential employee the opportunity, if they pull it, the employee has an opportunity to submit a written explanation of the credit report. Because I'm getting a feeling that we're going to have a hard time drafting this thing to sort of take all these things in. But I think your point about people being able to respond is absolutely the crux of this bill. Meaning, I can see it exactly, people having a hardship and not being able to respond, and then it just becomes a bigger and bigger block. At the same time, it seems like it's a valuable tool to a lot of employers. So what about a form that says, yes, you can pull my credit report specifically, and then, yes, I'd like to respond, and the employer would need to receive and consider a written explanation of the credit report. Is that something that would kind of address the issues?
Chair Rosenbaum, Senator George. The inaccuracies in ability to respond is only one reason why we support this change. Another reason becomes very apparent when I'm on the phone with the people that have allowed me to use their story and how difficult it is for them to speak to someone they trust. Many folks I've built relationships with over time, it's an organization they're familiar with, sharing this very personal, sometimes very real, it's not inaccurate information is emotional. It calls into question a lot of privacy issues about an individual to talk about their battle with cancer, and they didn't have the health care. And what did that mean for them and their family? As a individual, I would suggest that having that conversation with my potential employer certainly is a difficult place to sell myself as the employee that I am when I go to work 9 to 5. This is a lot of personal information about someone's hardest point in their life. We've seen not only in testimony from proponents, but from opponents admit that there is no proven correlation that the information about someone's credit has a bearing on their performance or their honesty. So why subject someone to sharing that if it doesn't show any results for them as an employee?
Thank you very much. Just an idea. Kind of spurred my interest, so.
Okay, well, I don't see any other questions for this panel. And is there anyone else in the room that wants to testify today on this bill? I do see representatives from the industry, and at our hearing on January 12th, we did have an expert witness from TransUnion. I know he was not able to get here again from Chicago today for this hearing, so certainly when we take the bill up again, we will afford him ample time to talk about what's proposed in this bill. I also am going to ask our administrator to share with the people on the committee. I know some of you were here for our pretty lengthy January 12th hearing, but I know people are busy, but there was a lot of written material put out and as well as some video material. So we'll try to get you that in summary form in a way that would be helpful for you to look at. So I don't see anybody else signed up to testify. I believe, Jim, under our rules, I am supposed to carry Senate Bill 1045 over to our next hearing.
Yes.
And so I have now officially done that.
Be done.
And then, so do I need to close or?
You just close the hearing.
You want to open. Yes, Senator Brzezinski, I will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 1045, and I will reopen a work session on Senate Bill 1017. I'm going to ask for a rule suspension to allow Senator Brzezinski, who was excused, to vote on Senate Bill 1017. Is there objection to the rule suspension? Hearing none, so ordered. And Senator Brzezinski, Senate Bill 1017 was a bill that was the small business loan.
Yep.
We sent that with an enthusiastic to pass to the Ways and Means Committee. How do you vote?
Enthusiastically. Aye.
Great. Thank you very much. For that, I'll close the work session on Senate Bill 1017. And with nothing further to come before us today, members, we are adjourned. Thanks for hanging in there.